It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Cases of flu and other respiratory illnesses are at very high levels across Wisconsin, according to data from the state health department.
Since September, the state reports more than 2,000 flu-related hospitalizations, impacting people 65 and older the most.
We're digging into flu risk and prevention amid the spread of other respiratory illnesses.
Megan Meller is an infection preventionist with Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. Megan, welcome back to Wisconsin Today. Megan, are you there?
I am.
Great.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear. Now, both the State Department of Health and the Wisconsin Academy of Family Physicians are saying, hey, the number of flu cases are high across the state. What are you seeing in the La Crosse area right now?
We are seeing a lot of influenza. You know, currently in hospitalizations, the majority of our patients hospitalized right now with different infections are hospitalized with influenza. We're seeing that mainly to among the patients who are 65 and older, like the state of Wisconsin, like general state of Wisconsin is seeing.
And sometimes people think flu, a pretty minor illness, and in a lot of cases will be pretty minor, but there are some serious risks that can come from influenza. Can you talk about why we worry about this?
One of the biggest risks with influenza is the infections that come afterwards. So what most people don't realize is that when someone's hospitalized with influenza, it's often with the bacterial pneumonia that comes after the infection. So people's immune systems are already pretty weakened, and then they end up getting a bacterial pneumonia, and that's what lands them in the hospital, usually with acute respiratory failure. This is primarily happening around people who have underlying health issues, sometimes with like COPD, other chronic health conditions. And they usually end up hospitalized for a few days needing oxygen until they can recover enough for discharge.
Now, we see, as you mentioned, this flu, mainly we worry about it for people 65 and older. We have seen one death of a child in Wisconsin recently, some cases elsewhere in the country. Rare. I don't want to alarm people. But when do we worry when we see influenza hit a kid and say, hey, we need to take some extra precautions, get in for extra treatment here?
With children and getting influenza, they can get really high fevers, and their immune systems can give a really strong response to the flu. And this is what can oftentimes result in death. And so it's really important, like I said, these are rare cases, but it's really important, especially in children, to make sure they're getting vaccinations. You know, one of the biggest advantages of getting vaccination for any age is that it really puts a curb on those complications that can come from flu. So most people, instead of feeling ill for, let's say, a couple of weeks and having maybe getting pneumonia, are going to recover a lot faster and be on their feet. So that's kind of the biggest thing that we can do for both kids and elderly, really for anyone of any age, is getting vaccinated.
Let's stay with vaccinations for a moment. Now, this time around, I got vaccinated in the fall. I've made that a habit. But back in the day, it wasn't such a habit for me. And this time of year, if I hadn't had one, well, I might think it's February, flu season's coming in, it's too late for me to get a vaccine. Rob was wrong, right?
Yeah, my favorite phrase this time of the year is it's never too late to get the flu shot. Vaccines usually take about 2 weeks until you are fully protected from it, but they will start working pretty quickly. And so it's really important to, if you haven't even gotten one yet, to go ahead and get one. You know, we're still offering them within our healthcare facility. They're pretty easy to get throughout the community, and they're really going to help people bounce back quickly from the flu. So you might feel miserable for a day or two, but you're not going to have those that long-term feeling of illness.
Can you talk about treatment of influenza for the worst cases? What kind of treatments are out there?
For patients that are at high risk for developing these complications, we usually look at pregnant moms, those with underlying health issues. There are antivirals available, like Tamiflu, that can be given usually within the early phases of illness. So it's really important if you are high risk and you just started having symptoms of flu, to reach out to your healthcare provider and get on those antivirals quickly, because they're not usually as effective if they're given later in the illness course.
And then you mentioned the real danger is you get the influenza. That's a virus, but that opens the door to pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia. So I'm guessing in those cases where people are being especially hospitalized for this, antibiotics might be part of the picture then.
Absolutely. By the time they're coming into the hospital with pneumonia, not only are they getting supplemental oxygen, but they're also getting antibiotics to fight that bacterial pneumonia. I think it's just important for people to remember that antibiotics aren't going to be useful for that initial phase of influenza. It's really getting antivirals if you need them, taking care of yourself. But again, if you're developing that pneumonia, then your provider will often give you antibiotics to treat that piece.
We're talking about the spread of influenza, and we'll get into some other respiratory viruses as the flu season continues. Megan Meller is with us, infection preventionist with Gunderson Health System. Megan, my favorite way to deal with the flu, of course, is to not get it at all over the course of the season. Apart from vaccines, what are some of our hygiene tips that can help prevent getting and or spreading influenza?
My favorite hygiene tips work for pretty much every respiratory illness, and that is making sure that you're washing your hands. People don't often realize how many times they touch their face with dirty hands until they really start to notice it becomes kind of in their forefront. But washing your hands regularly throughout the day with soap and water, using hand sanitizer if you're out in public, just being mindful that you're not touching your face, let's say after touching that grocery cart or, you know, at the, you know, department store. Covering your cough. If you have a cough, throwing on a mask, making sure that you're not spreading that cough to others. And just in general, we always say that if you're not feeling well, making sure that you're staying home and taking care of yourself, getting nutritious foods, getting enough sleep. These are all things, too, that you can even do preventative to help prevent you from getting sick later on in the season.
Now, back in the first year of COVID, 2020, obviously not a great year in a lot of ways. But interestingly, hospitalizations for influenza in the state, 28, if I read the numbers right. We're talking about a couple thousand now. Obviously, we're not going to take some of the more extreme measures just for influenza that brought those numbers down. But did we learn some lessons in that year of what can keep flu from spreading and being a hazard to people?
Right. You know, well, the thing with influenza is that each year is going to be a little bit different. So it can be really unpredictable to see how things are, you know, how the virus is going to play out. What we did see with COVID was when masking got implemented and, you know, a lot of people were masking, they were staying home, they weren't moving about, is we saw a decrease in other respiratory conditions. We didn't see as much flu. We didn't see as much RSV. And, you know, in some ways that's really good, especially for our patients who are immunocompromised. And so it's really that distancing. It's being mindful of hand hygiene that can really go a long way, too, in just reducing some of these infections from year to year.
Now, we're mainly talking about influenza here, but this RSV, respiratory virus, help me out, yeah.
Yeah, respiratory syncytial virus.
Thank you.
You know, another virus that we typically see every single year that... We, like flu, we have to also manage, but that impacts kids who are usually infants more severely than anyone else.
And the levels are high but stable, whereas flu has been going up. Is this something you're seeing a lot at Gunderson and in the La Crosse area, the RSV showing up?
So with RSV, we typically test for that in our younger kids, but because for many adults, if they get RSV, it's going to look like the common cold, and it's not something that you would typically test for. But among our pediatric populations, we are seeing, you know, kids who are being kids, especially, you know, infants under the age of one being positive for RSV. So it's still out there. It's still something that we watch really closely because no one wants to have their infant hospitalized.
And are we vaccinating for RSV? And if so, who should be thinking about that?
We do have some treatments out for RSV now, which is really exciting. You know, these have started coming out in the past couple of years. So right now we are still offering, and it's like an antibody treatment. It's called Beyfortus, and that's for children under 5. There are certain eligibility criteria for that. So I recommend that if a parent of a young child wants to they want to get them vaccinated or get them that RSV treatment, to reach out to their provider to determine eligibility. Also during the winter, like the fall and winter months, we do offer an antibody or vaccine for pregnant mothers as well. So that way they're protecting their newborn once they're born. That is no longer available simply because right now when moms are currently pregnant now, they're often delivering in the summer. That's when there's less of a risk for getting RSV.
And then finally, COVID-19 numbers, I know, had gone up in December and through the holidays. If I understand correctly, that's declined some since then. So maybe a bit of good news on the virus transmission front there.
Yeah, it's definitely a good news with COVID. You know, we're still trying to figure out its trends throughout the year, but we are seeing a decrease right now, which is good since we're busy managing influenza. That's not to say that cases can eventually climb again. We do start to see cases of COVID climb in the fall, but at least or in the summer. But right now, in terms of hospitalizations, we're not seeing that many patients hospitalized with COVID-19 currently.
So I want to end with some practical advice. Let's start with parents. Any parent has been there. Is my kid sick enough to where I should call the doctor? When we're looking at respiratory illnesses, especially for those younger kids, what are some of those symptoms and signs that say, yeah, give a call?
You know, for me, if my child was having a really high fever, like 103, 104, if they're not able to keep fluids down, if they're having dry diapers, that's when I would be picking up the phone and reaching out to my doctor to see what kind of steps that we can take to help my child out. So pay attention to that. If a child has any signs of respiratory distress, like blue lips, make sure you're getting them into the doctor as soon as possible. And even if, you know, these same things, if you are of any age and you're having a really high fever, it doesn't hurt to call your doctor. Or if you're over the age of 60 and having these same symptoms, reaching out and just seeing what next steps you should take.
Yeah, and I wanted to go to that older end of the spectrum now, age 60, 65 and up, those high fevers, obviously. What other symptoms or maybe pre-existing conditions should make people a little quicker to seek some help?
Usually, if you have an underlying, like a respiratory pre-existing condition like COPD, any of these respiratory conditions are just going to be a lot harder to fight. So paying attention to that. If you have underlying immune conditions, especially if you're immunocompromised, those are also something to pay attention to. And it would also make people eligible, let's say, for antivirals for COVID or for influenza and even the vaccine. So there's a vaccine eligible for vaccine for the elderly for RSV too. So looking into those preventative measures as well, just to make sure that you have your ducks in a row.
And Megan, you mentioned earlier influenza season. It's hard to predict. Typically, when do we start to say, okay, this is the typical end of flu season in Wisconsin?
Wisconsin has a really robust laboratory system where we keep track of positive test rates. So hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we'll start to see those cases start to decline. We'll feel within the community as well, but it's a little bit too early to say for right now when that peak of influenza is coming or whether it's here or not.
Megan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Megan Meller, infection preventionist with Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. We've been talking about this year's flu season in Wisconsin and some of the other respiratory illnesses that are going around.
Coming up, find out how Wisconsin schools are working with students to understand artificial intelligence and apply it to their future careers.
These things are going to grow and change rapidly, and the workforce, in general, has to be able to grow and change rapidly with the opportunities and the applications that are out there.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. School districts around Wisconsin are grappling with artificial intelligence and chatbots in the classroom and how they set school policy on the use of those products.
Some have tried to ban the applications altogether. Others are trying to embrace AI as a tool to enhance student learning.
It can be hard for schools to keep up with emerging technology like this, so we're checking in on how different districts in the state are approaching the challenge.
The school district of Monroe doesn't currently have a formal policy on AI. But administrators are working through these conversations now to determine what, if any, applications it could have in its schools.
Josh Wilson is the associate principal of Monroe High School. Josh, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, how has the topic of artificial intelligence been coming up at Monroe High School? What got the conversation going in your district?
Yeah, so I can speak from the high school level. So Monroe High School principal Jeremy Jackson came in to my office and asked me if I was aware of artificial intelligence in terms of ChatGPT, things of that effect. I said, I'm not really at all. So he shared it with me. And I started, kind of playing around with it a little bit, asking it questions. And my first thought, I taught before I became an associate principal. I taught history for 16 years. And of course, my first thought was, okay, so if kids use this, this is how we'll check for plagiarism and things to that effect. So that was my first kind of interaction with it. And then we started to have some really interesting conversations about, how can we have our students use this technology while still maintaining the the goals of education in terms of, you know, students arriving at their own answers, students engaging in the learning process, engaging in the thought process. And so really what originally started as this conversation about how am I going to catch kids plagiarizing turned into this larger conversation about what kind of assignments do we want to give kids? What kind of activities do we want them to do? What kind of learning experiences are important for our students at Monroe to prepare them for the rest of their lives after they graduate from high school?
When you talk to teachers and your other colleagues about AI and chatbots, do you hear more fear and concerns or curiosity and excitement? What's the tone of a lot of the conversation, the talk that you're hearing?
Really, we kind of run all over the place, right? We have plenty of teachers who are concerned about, you know, some of the assignments that that they give to kids and how they can really assess what a student knows. We have other teachers who are really leaning into AI and challenging their kids to work with the program. You know, it just runs the whole spectrum of classroom experiences and discussions about, again, what kind of activities and assessments and experiences we really want for our kids.
Do you have a sense of how much students in Monroe had already been using AI maybe for their classwork, whether we knew it or not or wanted them to or not?
Yeah, so, you know, AI is not a new thing, right? And I kind of smile a little bit when I think about, I don't know how old you are, but, you know, technology always changes, mm-hmm. right? And so I remember as a kid, as I don't know how old you are, but probably some of your listening audience remembers the same thing, that you'll never, doing math classes, right? You'll never carry a calculator with you all the time. Well, I do now, you know, and I remember it was early in my undergraduate career when Wikipedia came out, and that was the death knell of research, you know, and now we've used it, and we've, at least as a launching point for further research. So we know that kids are using and have used AI. In terms of ChatGPT specifically, you know, we don't really know what students are familiar with and what students aren't familiar with. I think we have some guesses based on some of conversations that I've had with kids. But, you know, that goes back to the conversation of, we know that kids are going to use this. We know that even if we block it at school, kids are going to find a way. Kids are resourceful, and they're going to find a way to use it. So what's the lesson that we want kids to have? To not access this whatsoever, or to teach the kids how to use ChatGPT while, again, maintaining fidelity to an assignment or to an assessment that's getting them to challenge themselves and to grow academically.
We're talking to Josh Wilson, associate principal at Monroe High School, looking at artificial intelligence in his school, as a lot of schools are working on policy on the use of chatbots, what students can and can't do with it. What kind of conversations are you having now, Josh, about a policy to have, something that might cover all your classrooms in the school about what to do and what not to do?
Yeah, so we've had a lot of great conversations with it. We've had a lot of conversations with all the departments, basically, or I should say staff members within those departments. I think right now teachers just want some guidance. So I reached out to a number of administrators in the Rock Valley Conference, which is what we are as a athletic conference, just to see what policies look like. I also have reached out to some other colleagues and friends that I have throughout Wisconsin and the Midwest. And really, the policies are all over the place. You know, if we outright ban the technology here in Monroe High School, are we doing a disservice to our kids when they go off to the workforce, or if they go off to college and they are in a class with somebody who has been taught how to use AI in a productive, meaningful way? I don't know what our policy is going to look like. You know, technology, you know, I had a conversation with somebody the other day about discussing the limitations of AI. And, you know, certainly it's not perfect, but, you know, with the thing with technology is that it constantly improves. And so I don't know where our policy will go, but I think our teachers deserve some guidance, as do our students.
You mentioned having taught history, and that made me think, I think 8th-ish grade back in the day, I had to write a paper on the Battle of Antietam in the U.S. Civil War. Now, I know if I'd had ChatGPT and I gave it a prompt, write me a paper about Antietam, and I printed it off and handed it in, that wouldn't have done much for young Rob's learning experience. What are some of the ways you think that you know, a person in that position could take a topic like that, use maybe a chatbot to come up with a good product, and maybe help them learn maybe even more than I did with my poorly handwritten paper back in the day?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So you know, again, I'm not teaching history right now, but if I were, I would say to you, I mean, what is the goal of learning about this particular conflict, right? Is it that you need to know that it's a turning point in the Civil War, that it's the single bloodiest day in American history? So rather than just saying, write me a report about it, right? It goes back to a teacher kind of thinking about what is a skill, what is the experience that I want you to have as a student? And I think that helps us develop, you know, an overarching sense of, you know, as a history teacher, sadly, you realize that most of my students aren't going to be history majors, right? And so what is it that I want a student to be able to do and experience and to learn and to use moving forward in a history class with the understanding that, you know, there's an artificial intelligence program out there, and how do I find a way to balance a kid using artificial intelligence while also getting them to understand, you know, the Battle of Antietam in a larger conversation about the Civil War, or a larger conversation about, you know, civil conflicts wherever they may be.
Josh, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
Josh Wilson is the associate principal of Monroe High School. He was with us today to talk about how his district is working through how it wants to handle artificial intelligence in classrooms. Now we're turning our attention to a Wisconsin school district that is already leaning into AI with the hopes of teaching students how to use it responsibly. The Unified School District of De Pere is running a trial period of an artificial intelligence program. It's called Brisk Teaching for grades 7 through 12. Kathy Van Pay is the director of elementary curriculum and instruction at the Unified School District of De Pere. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I imagine at school districts often, if the idea of artificial intelligence for kids comes up, the gut reaction might be, no, no way. But as you thought about it there in De Pere, you wanted to take a more proactive approach. What led you to want to try something, and we'll get into Brisk in a minute, but some program like Brisk with your students?
Sure. It really starts, you know, kind of grassroots from our teachers, our tech integration coaches. People are using things already because there are so many free options out there. And so we as a district like to do things that we call freedom within fences. We want to make sure that our atmosphere is safe and that we're using things appropriately. And so we basically really found out more about what people are using as free options and how they're using it in the classroom, and are trying to get caught up, so to speak, which I think is the case for most school districts, and get caught up with what is already in practice and do things that provide us with a little bit of fencing in, making for a safer environment.
And that fencing reminds me, I gather the phrase Wild West came up a lot in some of the early meetings, talking about how people were using all the different chatbot and whatever options that are out there.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there are so many options that are out there that people who think they're not using AI really probably are and don't necessarily realize it. If you're using Siri or Alexa or things like that, it's really, you know, artificial intelligence based.
Well, let's talk about what you are trying there, this Brisk teaching tool. What is it? How are students interacting with it?
Sure. So far, we're getting this rolled out to teachers first, and we're in the process of getting that rolled out to students. The way Brisk works, it's a lot more kind of like a Grammarly app in a sense. It does some of the things that Grammarly does, or, you know, checking for grammar and things like that. It does a little bit more than that. And that is also helping to provide that research angle that students will be able to use. Teachers are able to use that as well and do it within, you know, those fences or so on. And so what happens is that when teachers and students are using it, it's its own environment. It does not feed anything into what's called the large language model. And so it's not helping AI grow in that sense. It's using what AI has, taking from it, and then being able to provide that information to teachers and to students. So right now, we'll likely be able to see this in more use with students for writing and providing feedback in writing, and also having students be able to research things and look for things and get examples of things and so on and use that in their writing.
A concern about the use of chatbots, say, to write that paper is, well, the student just has the chatbot write the paper. They're not doing the work. They're not doing the thinking. Therefore, they didn't get anything out of this. Well, it sounds like what you're doing is a little more complicated than that and is trying to keep that student or will be trying to keep that student engaged in that process. What could that look like?
Sure. I mean, teachers, you know, first of all, we're rolling out what professional development looks like for teachers. And, you know, and part of that is sharing in how you use BRISC, but how you use artificial intelligence, you know, in general. And it also is about the policy and the reasons for the policies that we have related to artificial intelligence so that we can maintain it for appropriate use. Because we don't want teachers just developing their own curriculum from it. We still provide a guaranteed and viable curriculum within our school district. And then also for students, you know, we don't want them to be able to just do anything with it and have it be like the Wild West. And so, you know, we use it to enhance the writing, but not to do the writing for you. And so BRISC actually, you know, provide suggestions, but it does not just do the writing for you.
I want to talk more about the teacher training things because, you know, a teacher might be thinking, well, gosh, I've got my subject matter, math or English or whatever the case may be, and I'm trying to manage a classroom and work at the curriculum and get things graded and so on. And now we're artificial intelligence experts, too. How does this program help bring teachers on board?
Sure. I think, you know, part of it is thinking about change implementation, you know, within an organization. And so some of it is bringing people on board who are ready for it and wanting to and are excited, and then having that buzz and that information, you know, spread across teachers who maybe don't have as much knowledge about it or are not as interested. They find out more of what you can do. And so in terms of like that time management piece, teachers, so many people, especially in the middle and high school levels, are, you know, it's not just about writing in an English language arts class. You know, you're using writing in just about every content area. And so teachers are correcting all of that. They're looking at what has the student written? What are they learning from this? Are they able to express that in writing? So instead of having to go through every single piece of paper, they can provide some feedback along the way by simply putting portions of that paper or the whole paper in a artificial intelligence, or in our terms for BRISC, and provide, you know, to be able to provide some feedback to students. So it's very in, you know, in the sense that it saves some time, you know, they will be able to save a little bit of time by using this. And so having to learn a little bit about it takes some time, but it'll pay, you know, pay back in the time that they save in providing feedback to students.
We're talking about artificial intelligence in Wisconsin schools. Kathy Van Pay is with us from the Unified School District of De Pere. Can you talk, Kathy, about the skills we're hoping students develop? Because whether we like it or not, they're going to come out into a world and a workforce that has lots and lots of AI that we can't even imagine yet, possibly. What are you hoping that using a program like BRISC is going to prepare them for?
Sure. It is definitely preparing them for life. And I think a big piece of it is just that flexibility of mind, because these things are going to grow and change rapidly. And the workforce, you know, in general has to be able to grow and change rapidly with the items that are out there, the opportunities and the applications that are out there. One of the things that, you know, definitely I've heard is a need is that in our technical colleges and our universities, you know, they have students coming in who are trying these things out, but they've never actually been taught how to use and not use them. And so, you know, it tends to be a little bit of the Wild West in those levels as well. And so people within our district who have ties to universities and technical colleges are definitely saying, we're so glad that you're doing this in the schools, because the next round of students coming into, you know, post high school education definitely will have some of those skills built in before they get there. Right now, I think a lot of the levels are just trying to kind of catch up. And so if we're doing this in the public schools K-12, or in our case, it's 7-12, this will be helpful for them as they roll into what's next in life, whether it's school and then career or career right off the bat.
Then looking down the road when this is fully up and running, how do you evaluate success or room for improvement?
Sure. Partly that starts with, the anecdotal evidence from our teachers. It also, providing any evidence that we have in terms of disciplinary things that occur, if there's a misuse and so on, that helps us to know, how many incidences are there of that and what do we need to do to respond to that. I think the nice thing about using a more specific application like BRISC is that we receive usage information, so we can break that down into smaller groups as which departments are using it, which content areas, how is it being used, and so on. And that really gives us an idea, really, of how everything's working. So we put all of those pieces together.
Kathy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Kathy Van Pay is the Director of Elementary Curriculum and Instruction at the Unified School District of De Pere. She was with us to share how her school district is implementing artificial intelligence in the classroom. And earlier we heard from Monroe High School Associate Principal Josh Wilson about how the Monroe School District is working to form its own AI policies.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a Menasha restaurant owner wins a national award for her Chicago-style hoagies.
When I create my hoagies, I tap into the inner child in me, and I think we forget to do that. I think if everybody tapped into their inner child, we will be better as people.
The art of sandwich making and keeping a restaurant buzzing, that's next on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the love of friendships on this Valentine's Day.
The roots of many female friendships are strong and can run deep. They certainly do for writer Jan Mireles Larson of Eau Claire. She shared a story about being in the company of women at a live Wisconsin Life storytelling event in Eau Claire at the Lakely.
We were 12. Most strangers, all women, joined for 4 days in the common goal of sea kayaking the caves along the shores of Lake Superior's late summer. But first, we had to fall out of a kayak. "Who wants to be first?" our guide called out with an enthusiasm meant to overcome the silence sure to follow such an absurd question. The water was cold. Who would ever intentionally dump their kayak? Turns out, me. "I'll do it." Sighs of relief, round of applause from my new friends. But I was in the company of women. And when in the company of women, I am free to be as bold or as vulnerable or as unburdened as I choose. Now, my earliest memories of the space women hold for one another were gathered at a neighbor's kitchen table. While sipping their hot brews, my mom and Mrs. Cruz would tell stories. I was the quiet mouse in the other room, quietly reading a book, but also a sponge, soaking up the promise of joy in the connections made when women are present for one another. Years later, during a period of uncertainty and illness, I found truth in the Chinese proverb that women hold up half the sky. Women from every corner and decade of my life held me. Cards, letters, phone calls, flowers, tea, gifts of time and food, all let me know that they cared, that I mattered. It was the promise of joy glimpsed in that kitchen of long ago, fulfilled. Two friends were relentless in their presence. When all I could do was walk a few steps, Julia dragged me first down the driveway, then up a hill and back again, until 1 mile became two, and two became four. Soon, Emily had me strength training 3 days a week. The physical activity was great, but the hundreds of conversations that we had that allowed us to deepen our connection, that was priceless. Emily and Julia led me back to the physical strength to say yes. So when my friend Mo suggested a weekend paddling Lake Superior with 10 strangers, I was ready. Ready enough to volunteer to fall out of a kayak first. As we paddled, as we devoured meals around the campfire, we began to share our joys, our worries, our feelings, our dreams, our stories. And although our ages and experience spanned more than 6 decades, we were there to know and be known. These days, I have been delighted to witness that same joy present in our adult daughters' friendships. Whether piling in a heap like a litter of puppies while they settle in for a good chat, scrolling through social media posts to vet their friend's newest love interest, or showing up in celebration, or if needs must, in mourning, they give one another the gift of unconditional love, fierce devotion, and the joy found in the company of women.
Jim Mireles Larson shared that piece on the company of women at a live storytelling event in Eau Claire at the Lakely. It was hosted by WPR's Wisconsin Life and the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild. To hear her full story and learn about why she wanted to talk about friendship on stage, go to wisconsinlife.org or check out the Wisconsin Life podcast. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
The ketchup giant Heinz recently announced the winners of a grant program to celebrate and preserve the legacy of Black culinary traditions in America.
Lona Young is one of three winners in Wisconsin of the Heinz Black Kitchen Initiative. Born and raised in Chicago, Young moved to Menasha 25 years ago and started her restaurant business in 2019. It's fittingly named Chicago's House of Hoagies. And Lona Young joins us now. Welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You are one of three Wisconsin recipients of grants from the Heinz Black Kitchen Initiative this year. What does it mean for you to receive this recognition?
It means a lot. The African-American community, small entrepreneurs don't get that recognition. And to give that to us, that's amazing that they're using their huge platform to say, hey, we need to recognize these people. They work hard. They need help. They need support.
Have you thought about how you'll put this grant to use?
Oh, I've already used it. I used it for my taxes. I used it on taxes and some repairs that I needed to get done at the restaurant. Like those little things you don't really think about when you're sitting down doing your business plan and mapping everything out. You forget that, oh, wait, the garbage disposal might go out. I need to put a fund aside for that. Or maybe the refrigerator goes out and you bought it and it only has a 1-year warranty. So like all those little expenses, they add up so quick. And these are things that you have to keep done in order to keep your business open.
Take us back to 2019. How did House of Hoagies come into being?
From a Facebook post, believe it or not, I made a hoagie and I posted on Facebook like I do all my food because I'm a foodie. I like to eat and show what I'm creating. And I post a hoagie that I had made and I start getting messages from people that I'm friends with And they thought that I was in Chicago at the House of Hoagies, and they were asking me to bring them one back. And I was like, oh no, I made this in my kitchen. And they're like, well, can you make me one? And I was like, no, like, why would you want me to make you a hoagie? But the demand was there. And so I put a post on Facebook like, hey, I'm inviting 30 people to my home for a tasting. I want people who are either from Chicago or Philadelphia, and you have to be an everything eater. You can't come to my house if you don't eat tomatoes or onions or mayo. I don't want you. And I'm not trying to be mean. I need everything eaters, and I need people from them demographics, because hoagies are big in those areas. So they're going to be able to critique me, tell me what I need to fix, what they don't like, what they did like. And from there, I got my first catering order. And it was like, the feedback was amazing. I did make some changes based off that first meeting that I had. And it's been doing great. I started doing farmers market and pop-up events and catering. And I was like, maybe this is a thing. I've been doing great. It has had its obstacles, but for the most part, it's been really great.
When you walked into your storefront for the first time, could you believe it?
No. Oh, my God. Once it was all done, mind you, when I started the construction, literally COVID happened.
Yeah.
My construction. And it's like a ton of bricks fall on you. Mm. And you're like, oh, my God, because we're all going through something new that no one's ever experienced. And we don't know the outcome of it. And you've invested all your money into this. You got deposits every place, and the world is shut down.
But you found a way. You found a way.
I did. That was God. That was God. And that was the community. And when I walked in the finishing product, I was like, oh, my God, this young lady from the south side of Chicago, Algale Housing Projects, is doing great things.
Luna, how do these hoagies tell your history, tell your story?
Because I'm from Chicago, and when people see the name Chicago, the first thing they ask when they walk in, are you from Chicago? And then they always want to put you to the test. Well, I want us to be ahead of the game. So when I created my menu, I wanted to make sure that my menu stamped like, yes, this girl is from Chicago. Not, oh, I'm from Dalton, or I'm from Maywood. Baby, no, that's not Chicago. Chicago is Chicago with a Chicago zip code. So I made sure that each one of my hoagies told you where I am from, what neighborhoods I hung out, and where me and my friends hung out. For example, I have a Ford City hoagie. That's going to tell my Chicago people like, oh, my God, her and her friends hung out at the Ford City Mall. She's legit, you know, or I'm from Algale Housing Projects. I have a hoagie called Algale Gardens. They're going to, oh, she's from out south. She's from 131st in Michigan. She's the real deal. She knows how we like our food. It's going to be messy. It's going to be flavorful. And that's how you keep that customer base, because people want to know that you're authentic. They walk into a New York deli, they want to feel like they're walking into like that bodega in their neighborhood. If people walk into a Chicago restaurant, they want to feel like they're walking into their neighborhood. They don't want to come and it's like, she ain't even make this right. This doesn't feel like home. You want the food to feel like home. So my menu tells you I'm from Algale Housing Projects. I live in Block 13 on 131st in Michigan. And I have all those hoagies on my menu.
These hoagies tell such a rich story. We're talking with Lona Young, who owns a sandwich shop, House of Hoagies. It's in Menasha, and recipient of a recent grant aimed at strengthening the presence of Black culinary traditions in American food culture. You found success with your business on social media, particularly you're crushing TikTok. What has social media meant for your business?
I get most of my customers off of social media, because we live in a social media world right now. So people are on social media. So my platforms is Facebook, TikTok, Instagram. And as a small business owner, you have to remember, you have to be consistent with those platforms. You have multi-billion dollar companies like Walmart, Target, Shein, who are aggressively on these platforms. So that should tell you, as a small business owner, you have to be aggressive as well. And I get a lot of traffic off of those.
Through the thick and thin of creating these hoagies, do you have a favorite one? Do you have a standby?
Oh my God, my favorite, hands down. Well, I have a few, but my top two is going to be the Ford City and the River Oak. So the Ford City is, it comes on an ungrilled hoagie roll with mayo, provolone cheese, pepper jack cheese, sliced chicken deli meat, tomatoes and onions with cheese potato chips on top, salt and pepper and olive oil. Oh my God. That just screams childhood memories. I got to get home before the street lights. I can hold this and run with my friends and play, you know? And it's crazy because when I create my hoagies, I tap into the inner child in me. And I think we forget to do that. When I create, I want to make sure I'm tapping into your inner childhood because that's going to make you a better person. And then my next one is the River Oaks. That one comes on an ungrilled hoagie roll with provolone and pepper jack cheese, sliced chicken deli meat, tomatoes and onions, pickle slices, mild banana peppers, salt, pepper, mayo, basil, and avocado oil. That is my I can eat that one probably every day. That one is so amazing. And if you're a true Chicagoan, baby, we love extra oil and basil and we want it dripping down our arm.
Oh my goodness, my mouth is watering. Do you have a New Year's resolution for yourself or for Chicago's House of Hoagies? Something you're really looking forward to trying to achieve next?
A lot of people don't know that I have a Feed the Children thing that I do in my restaurant. So if any child walks in my restaurant and tell me that they're hungry, there's no questions asked. I feed them. I don't need to know your story. I don't need to know any of that. I'm going to feed you. So I just, one of my things I do offer in the community. And then once a year, this year was my first event. I did a Feed the Community event where I fed the community. No questions asked. It was a free to the community. I did free face painting for the kids, free bounce house. We gave away free diapers, ties for men that were trying to get back into the workforce. And we fed everybody. No matter race, color, creed, age, whatever, if you're hungry and you need to eat, come and eat. We waste so much food in this country. No one should ever go hungry. So I'm all about, I'm going to feed you.
Lona, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us and congratulations.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate this a lot.
Lona Young is the owner of Chicago's House of Hoagies in Menasha. She's one of the three Wisconsin winners of the Heinz Black Kitchen Initiative to celebrate and preserve the legacy of Black culinary traditions. And I spoke with her last month. We would love for you to chime in about your genius sandwich creations. What do you load on? How do you approach your condiments on this perfect sandwich creation? Or do you have a neighborhood establishment with amazing sandwiches? Get in touch with us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
In coming days, we're exploring children's books that feature historical figures, and the books have Wisconsin ties.
Is there a biography written for children that's had an impact on your life? Maybe something you read as a kid or something you've read to your own children? Or if you're a teacher or librarian, is there one you want to share?
Tell us about it. You can email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Or you can call or text us. Either way, the number is 888-642-0232. Again, that number, 888-642-0232.
Then we can share your reading suggestions on a future show.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.